Okay, welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on what effect these are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Today we have two guests joining us. First is the managing partner of Merida Capital Partners, a cannabis-focused private equity firm. You can see him participate on the Global Cannabis Town Hall that occurred on April 2nd. Recordings available on newfrontierdata.com. Please welcome Mitch Berukowitz. Hi, Mitch. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And then our second guest is a senior member of our research team here at New Frontier Data. Please welcome our Director of Industry Analytics, Casey Marcy. Thanks for joining us, Casey.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have a lot to cover. We're going to cover a couple of news stories, and then we're going to let you guys kind of dive into some interesting topics. CFTrends.com reported cannabis ETF could be a post-420 redemption story. So there's been shifts in consumer behavior, impacting every area of the economy, and cannabis is no exception. We've seen consumption increase as high as 159% year over year in some markets because of the shelter-in-place order. Mitch, how should investors be thinking about the short and long-term implications this could have on cannabis financial markets?
Well, I mean, just covering the ETF world alone, Merida, we don't love the articulation of a cannabis investing strategy through the ETF alone. Obviously, as a private investor, we're much more focused on private investments. But we do think, you know, for the first time, probably at least since the rapid driven advent of the capital markets, that public pretty cheap. So an ETF is a great way to have a redemption story. I mean, we've started to see that a lot of the public companies, particularly MSOs, they continue to grow. Their revenues are scaling, primarily because of the growth of consumption alone in the legal market. And so I think investors, it's the long-term implication of whether it's COVID-driven acceleration, which really drove the stock market down, it's created a great opportunity to buy into the public markets per se, which we've typically avoided because we always thought things were probably a little bit high from a valuation perspective. So we do actually agree that after 420, with the COVID-driven acceleration of market downsliding, that a lot of stocks look cheap. And we think starting with tonight's Cresco earnings, you can start to see these MSOs who have been operating in a good way really put some good numbers on the board.
That's awesome. That's inspiring. Well, and if we take into concerns about the economic downturn, if it continues the way it is, do you think that cannabis could be considered a defensive investment, similar to alcohol with the last recession?
Well, I wrote that on Twitter, that people might start to see cannabis that way. But, you know, when I think of defensive investments, and I think a lot of people would agree, you know, having been in finance for 20 years, you think of defensive investments, you think of like garbage bags and toilet paper and Q-tips and consumer staples. And I think one of the real things that COVID, it's kind of rare that a pandemic or a one-time thing like a 9/11 type event where it's really shocking, let's call it a black swan event, although now that black swans happen every, you know, 3 or 4 years, it's hard to say they're black swans. But when these events occur, it's hard to find validation for any business in something like this. But cannabis, because of that emerging story and something that, you know, Casey and I were just riffing on before we started, which is a lot of cannabis's growth is coming from the black market. And so you're having a shift. It's not that cannabis is finding new consumers. There are plenty of new consumers coming to the plate. But the growth of cannabis alone is it's a story about an evolution, not a revolution, right? It's the evolution of illegal product consumption becoming legal through medical adult use, through state legalization. And so I do actually think it's, you know, industries tend to be recession-proof, companies aren't. So companies can clearly fail, even though cannabis itself is accelerating, right? Companies who spend too much or don't have efficient supply chain. But a few things we love about cannabis that we think COVID is validating: the hyper-local supply chain of cannabis, from grow to dispensary to the nutrients, that could be a 30-mile radius for the entire supply chain for a producer in their state. We like that sort of four walls, you know, the four walls of an entire supply chain within a 50, 60, 100-mile range, maybe. That's incredibly attractive when you talk about these sort of macro trends that can put pressure on other industries. So I do actually think cannabis will be seen like a defensive stock, but I don't think you can quite say defensive because of all the growth right now. So maybe long term, right now it's still an emerging growth story, and you typically don't find defensive stocks in the growth emerging, you know, in that trend line. Cannabis still has like this 30-40% industry growth. I'm not sure, you know, how many times do you see a defensive stock that has a growth curve directly up to the right? You know, up and to the right is not defensive. It's typically more level. So I think it will be seen long-term as defensive, but because of the medical vertical and the black market and new consumers, I think right now it's got a much greater story than just a defensive to go along with alcohol or tobacco or something of that nature.
Yeah, for sure. Let's switch gears. I wanted to talk about ancillary services in cannabis, particularly cannabis commercial real estate. BizNow.com reported that cannabis CRE expects extinction event and market corrections. So before the vaping crisis and economic slowdown due to COVID-19, capital availability was showing signs of trouble when valuations started plummeting. What are some of the implications that, which had previously, like for companies that relied on just capital raises? Is there a way to adapt in this new environment?
Well, I mean, if you own your own property, obviously that's always an asset you can tap. And I think that the market for tapping that has never been better. Real estate related lending in cannabis is exploding. And I think what you're starting to see, or at least we're starting to see, I mean, we get involved in a lot of these conversations because we own direct operating assets in a variety of states. What you're actually starting to see, which is most interesting, is a lot of real estate people in other places are willing to lend to cannabis companies for that yield, because the average yield on cannabis real estate is simply going to be a lot higher than the triple net lease rate. So from a commercial real estate standing, yes, companies who don't have access, if you're a leaser with no assets that you can borrow against, I think you could see a lot of problems across. Again, there's very little capital. So really what COVID did is accelerate what we already saw in the second half of 2019, where because of the declining stock prices, that puts the comps at a certain level. And then you see that sort of correlate and spiral throughout the entire cannabis ecosystem. So companies had very little access to capital in late 19. It looked like it was starting to trend back up in January and February, and then all of a sudden March hit, and it was just a brick wall. And I think what you're seeing is the companies who are going to not go extinct are going to be the companies who had already taken very draconian sort of, let's call it efficiency moves to get to a definable profitability trend. And those are the only companies that can really source capital right now. The story that's not resonating, I think, across the investment landscape is, give me 3 or 4 years to get profitable. In 2017, you could see, or 18, when capital was widely available, you could see decks that didn't even start talking about profit until 2022 and beyond. I don't even think you can go out 2 years anymore and really get any financing if you can't show a direct, you know, pipeline to profit within 2 years now, because the cannabis ecosystem is rapidly maturing. And I just don't, in an economic downturn, people want to see that risk mitigation. And so I think you're seeing real estate lending, that's going to be really the bulwark. But people who don't have real estate to borrow against or can't do sale and lease backs. You saw Cresco did a big sale and lease back that they closed recently. And they've done, GTI's done huge ones with IIPR. I think you're seeing the sort of unlocking of more efficient capital for the bigger companies. And that's going to really differentiate. So you're going to really see a sort of have and have nots in cannabis over the next 3 months. And it could definitely put incredible pressure on companies that are on the margin of error.
Right. Now, I know a lot of people were shocked that ancillary companies were excluded from the stimulus package. Was this shocking to you? I mean, since they're not touching, like they don't touch the plant, and that they were kind of excluded from that.
And I'm not sure that all ancillary companies are excluded. I know that there was a point about marijuana related businesses, but it's hard to say a company that serves equipment is serving. How do you prove how much of their business is cannabis? So I don't know if they're excluded. I know there's guidance, and I think some ancillary companies get close to the plant or closer to the plant, but it was a little bit shocking. I mean, I think the government, we're in this place where there's such a dislocation between the reality on the ground and what's actually happening in cannabis companies, especially ancillary companies who really don't touch the plant or aren't even that, you know, it's the nexus of where their revenue comes from, which has been used historically, whether it's the IRS or other government related, they like to look at this nexus of opportunity or nexus of revenue to effectuate policy choices that they want. But I think people would have a hard time with money going to entities that seem serving federally illegal businesses. But
it's interesting because they're deemed now essential businesses. So it's
that is pretty
wild.
There is a large divergence in cannabis that we just deal with every day. And, you know, you have to be able to deal with the dichotomy. I think the psychologist Maslow would get, you know, or Carl Jung would be very interested by the dichotomy you have to be in the cannabis industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I would love to kick it over to you two, since you guys are both the experts in the industry, because we did have a quick chat before we went live about the, supply chain and black market, and just would love to hear you guys' thoughts and kind of recap your discussion.
Well, this is where I can lean on Casey. I mean, I think there are certain areas that we are wildly intrigued by the data that's coming out, because we first of all, we think there's a shift coming in general in the use of data. When you think of, and you know, obviously as an investor in New Frontier, it's something that we've believed and it's been a shared vision with the management of New Frontier, Giada, Gary, Casey, everyone I've always had a conversation with, is it's really, you're now moving to a professionalized operator, right? The early operators were people that spent all their time in front of a plant and they were working just to survive this illegal at the federal level, lack of capital. So 16, 17, 18, real grind to build these businesses. And now you have the more, you know, almost like conglomerates where they need to have data. They need to use that operator's dashboard, that New Frontier, like what an Equio provides. And I think, you know, Casey, have you seen, we were talking before about the shift from black market. You know, people years ago were skeptical. How is cannabis going to grow this big? Where are you going to find all these new consumers? And you know my point, and I said this on the Global Town Hall, and I think there was a little bit of pushback, but I don't think we're finding new consumers. I just think they're changing the patterns of their consumption.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the illicit market, I think, is the one thing that a lot of legislators and regulators underestimate, is they think that they're introducing a new product and tax policies as such that, all right, we tax at this percentage, this means we're going to get X amount of dollars, without thinking about just the sheer mass of cannabis consumers that already exists. There definitely is some growth. We're definitely getting new people to try cannabis. There are new consumers coming online just because of the fact that it's legal. It's in a well-lit store. There are definitely new consumers, but the real base of cannabis consumption that happens in the country has been from people who have been consuming cannabis for years. And it's really just about which avenue they're going to purchase that cannabis from. And every state that sets up its regulations is really just trying to guide, they may not know it, but trying to guide the mass of already existing consumers to then decide to purchase from legal dispensaries.
Right. I think of this interesting, I'm writing something that is an analog for some of the early internet companies, and Amazon was a company I focused on. And I found it interesting that one of Amazon's biggest advantages in shifting consumption from bricks and mortar in the early 1999 or 2000 days was this huge tax benefit that they had by not, you know, the lack of taxation of internet related sales. You have one industry, like no one ever asked Amazon, like, how can you project the growth of book sales online? Because there's so much data around book sales and publishers, and that data was granular. But for you guys, I mean, you guys know a lot of data around the illicit market. You can do that through your econometrics. That was always one of the things that impressed me. And yet, no, you know, how come no one ever asked Amazon, like, how do you know you're going to sell books, right? And yet Amazon had this huge advantage of tax policy, which allowed them to offer goods cheaper than their competitors. Whereas in cannabis, obviously, we were talking before about how tax policy, I mean, if California, when you walk into a dispensary, a medical, a historical medical cardholder is paying 2% taxes or some low number. The guy with a medical card that's not ICO or pre-ICO paying 12% or something. And then the pure adult use, they're all buying the same stuff. But one guy's paying 36% taxes with an excise tax. One guy's paying 12, one guy's paying 2. And I think if California harmonizes tax policy, they're going to see legal sales explode. All of that usage is going to be coming out of the black market, right? That's going to be a shift from black to legal. That's new consumers probably aren't as, let's say, sensitive to tax policy or pricing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. So, but I think it's interesting that, you know, some advantages of the internet were the fact that can probably be the biggest new emerging industry that we can compare to cannabis. And yet cannabis, because of the existing usage, it doesn't have the benefit of any of that tax policy. That actually has the huge drag of tax policy.
Mm-hmm.
So can I ask, have you guys seen what has been the shift in people, in data that people are asking for, the operators? You know, have you guys seen like a pure shift to more of the consumer related data, or is it still the econometric, show us what markets look like?
We have a lot of people who are just asking for data on new markets. So if they think a state's going to legalize, there are a handful that are expected to pop this year, both medical and adult use. So we have a lot of people asking about potential sizes of those markets. So we're sizing the consumer population, looking at the illicit market, potential tax policy and pricing and things like that. But we also do have a lot of people asking about consumer stuff as well. So some existing operators who are really looking to hone in pricing strategies for certain product lines, really trying to get a sense of what products consumers are trending to, so that they can best meet demand in the upcoming months.
That's so interesting that it's one of the rare times in life where the operator literally does not know what their consumer wants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their consumer wants to participate in the usage of something. But like a state like Georgia, since it's only been illicit, I always think that the turn on these states, you know, I'm one of the operators in Virginia. We're going to bring the first product to market, it looks like. And, you know, day one, you open up a dispensary with the shell stock. Who knows what Virginians are going to want to use? Do they want, it's an extract only market. Are they going to want vape pens? Are they going to want tinctures? So there is so much variation. And it's amazing that you guys try to sort of extrapolate out. That's got to be the most challenging part of the data.
Well, we can see there's so many case studies. So we have all these states because the U.S. has legalized piecemeal. We have data from every state basically in order as they've legalized. We can watch the evolution of those product preferences happen across the consumer base. We can look at demographics and see that happen in other states. So as soon as a new state like Virginia will go, it makes it much easier to predict patient participation and product selection than if that were the first state. So some of these states are actually benefiting from coming on a little later. They're really learning all these lessons that other states had to learn. And since a lot of those product preferences already leaked into the black market, so the first few states that had legal vapes were really upping manufacture of edibles, different types of tinctures and things like that. Those eventually leaked their way into the black market or shipped onto the East Coast. So consumers who are in states that haven't yet legalized but are going to legalize have actually had sort of a head start if they're already consuming cannabis products on some of these new product forms. So it's not necessarily, you know, introducing Virginian cannabis consumers to vapes right for the first time like they would have been in an early medical state.
Well, that's why I think the biggest thing that I've seen over the, you know, 7 years that I've been in the legal medical markets, you know, the first market, very few patients get a medical card. The consumption is very lumpy. Then, you know, state number two, that's Connecticut. Then Minnesota sort of learns a little bit. And now you have, by the time a state turns on now, I think there's a much more mature and definable consumption and also the patients come on quicker. Their doctors are more educated.
Mm-hmm.
So in Connecticut, doctors were like, wait, this is legal. Now they didn't even know. Now, okay, it's another, you know, it's another arrow in the quiver. Sure. And I think the medical card recommendation, everything has become so much more efficient that you're not seeing these states kind of launch and then just do nothing for a year. I really think every state has benefited from each state before. And now even with adult use, they realize that, you know, a doctor would rather you use a product that's been labeled and quality tested and quality controlled. And it's been through a very highly regulated supply chain. And that's one of the biggest changes we see in the medical markets. Medical markets are almost more efficient now than adult use markets. You know, the first adult use market was in Colorado. It took a while for that to get rolling, right? There was this huge rush. And then it was, and even in that rush, medical stayed at, what, a $400 billion industry for at least a year or a few years. It's probably still $300 billion. And 300 million in Colorado.
Yeah, I mean, the timeline between legalization and the first sale, I mean, initially, a few years ago, that averaged about 2 years between when they would legalize and actually open a dispensary. But now we're seeing all these new states, that timeline is cut down significantly. And a lot of that also has to do with the benefit from existing multi-state operators who are taking their economies of scale and their expertise, and they're moving into these states, and they're able to start operations just much more quickly than the initial go-around.
Right. So you mean you pass a law. I mean, I think of my early experience, a law got passed in 2012, an application process got filled out by early 14, a license gets given out, first product gets to market in 14. Anyone who was already a medical card holder has been paying for 2.5 years for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So those people were like migrating out of Connecticut right at the time when product was about to hit the market. So
I wouldn't say for nothing, because there are a lot of states where people will just get a medical card for protection from being arrested.
So. That's a good point. But if there's no, you know, they didn't buy it legally if there's no product on the legal market yet. But that's, yeah. And we look at Missouri as one of the most amazing cases, which is it's the first state to really have a massive patient count before the first product is even close. You know, typically people will wait till 3 months before the first product is market. Missouri just finished their application process, just gave out the licenses. You know, we won 5 dispensary licenses there. First product's not going to be on the shelves till late 19. I don't even know if they'll be in product in 2020 because, you know, the first grows are just being built now. So you're looking at mid 2021 before a lot of product hits the market. Get 26 or 30,000 patients in Missouri is kind of a staggering number, given that there's no product available for the next year. But to your point, maybe it's a shield so that if anything happens and you have black market products.
It's definitely a shield. And a lot of people on the East Coast, if they can get a card, they will. And we might still be purchasing.
It's worth the $200, right?
Yeah, definitely. Just a tiny peace of mind. And then, you know, if the market, when it eventually opens, you'll be able to purchase. And also reciprocity for other medical states. If you travel to other states and you already have
it. That's a good point. Yeah. See, I didn't, you know, one of the things, I know the deviousness of that, I guess us in the legal market just don't even think that way anymore.
Got that black market mind.
I want to analyze it, but those are hard things. It's so idiosyncratic and we've never seen anything like it. You know, the COVID's unprecedented, so is cannabis. There's never been an industry, $300 billion globally, that turned legal. So I guess we'll have to learn in real time.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we're almost out of time. So before we say goodbye, Mitch, Casey, any parting words for our listeners?
Well, I would say that we are about to, this is a prediction I'll give, which I try to keep the predictions on the very low side because, you know what they say, everyone's got a take and they're often wrong. But I would say my prediction is the next 6 months are going to be wildly positive for cannabis as the more general sort of broad consensus starts to come around to the growth is there. All these highfalutin promises that were made over the last 2 or 3 years start to really become more tangible. The earnings are going to be there. Now, SG&A and scale, maybe not as perfectly as we'd like. But I think you're going to start to see a separation between the Canadian and U.S. operators, a much more refined mindset for the analysis of it. And as that happens, I think you're going to see equities trending up. And I think you're going to see a lot of companies who survive and come out of this with a lean mindset really, really succeed and thrive. And I think late 20 is going to be really, I think you're going to see some real valuation explosion over the next 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that, Mitch, and just to echo the essential business piece, I think it's just this coronavirus just really brought out the just how essential, I guess, you know what I mean?
Like the fundamental nature of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's not going away. Like, this is something we've been saying forever that, you know, this is, we all know the demand is there. These are our projections we've been putting on for years. Cannabis is going to be, it's just a matter of when. And this whole coronavirus situation brought out, well, now, you know, some states have people in jail for cannabis and they're now deeming these businesses essential.
Especially on the, I mean, it does, that's a great point that I'll end with, which is, you know, for a long time, we had to convince people that the growth was going to be there, that the consumption was there. It just needs to transition to a legal market and how we have these 4 stages and normalization is the last stage. This cannabis is one of the rare industries that's so hard to analyze because, and why I think, you know, you almost need a professional investor like Merida to help steward you through these idiosyncratic opportunities is because it's one of the few industries that is going to reach normalization around the same time that legalization occurs. Whereas most industries reach, like, the internet was already legal and it, you know, usage explodes and then it just becomes part of your life. Cannabis, it's very hard for the average person to make something part of their daily life, whether it's medical, whether it's CBD health and wellness, until it's legal, because the average person wants to be in accordance with the law, right? And I think you've already gotten the low-hanging fruit consumption in the, you know, people who don't care that we used to write, the people who didn't, the early cannabis consumer, the cannabis consumer that drove the industry to where it is was the guy who didn't care that he smelled in a party, or it was just the low-hanging fruit. That guy liked cannabis or that woman liked cannabis and they used it and it didn't really matter that there was a stigma attached. Once that full stigma, including legal, goes away, I think the normalization, you're going to see, like you said, a validation And COVID really, I personally think it accelerated a lot of the fundamental belief system that a lot of people in cannabis had already seen. But now the broader world goes, wow, there's 20 things that were deemed essential. To groceries is medical cannabis?
Yeah.
Okay. There is that dichotomy of having people in jail. And I think you're going to start to see that normalized sort of mindset going forward. And that really does drive the industry forward.
Yeah. Not to mention all the now drive-through curbside pickup delivery that's available. It's pretty incredible, the strides we've taken on that front.
It doesn't feel like this illicit place that you sneak into anymore when you're doing curbside. You know,
yeah.
It's funny because one of our location guys always wants to go near fast food. He's like, you always want to be near fast food. And we used to argue that it's a destination. It's not a place that like, hey, I'm going to get my groceries. I'm going to also stop into a dispensary. We don't really see consumption that way right now. But hey, you could be proven wrong by a pandemic, I guess. So now you just need a drive-through dry cleaner. You can literally do all your shopping in one shop.
I think a lot of states that have written delivery into their regulations are now seeing the benefit of that. And I think as each state, you know, every year you see revisions to the regulations as states develop their programs. I think we're going to see a lot in the next year. We're going to see a lot of regulation review over
what curbside actually might even be more challenging, because curbside, the fact that that's been built into almost every state now, shows that some of the, look, we've always argued, and this is going to sound very counterintuitive, but we've always argued that we think cannabis at the state level, particularly in medical markets, is wildly overregulated. The fact that curbside is not allowed, and you know, because everything needs to be controlled in the four walls of a dispensary, we've always argued that, you know, cannabis gets a scrutiny that no other industry has. And now you're right, like the pandemic sort of brought out a loosening of some of the four walls concept, and we think it can only be good. And especially large multi-state operators, they can manage these changes pretty well, and then they scale it across their multiple operations. So I've never been more excited, actually, to be an investor in cannabis. I've never been more, sort of engaged in the challenge of building these companies. And so that's a great note to leave on. Like, for me, this is an incredible time for people in the cannabis industry. And I really admire a lot of the innovation and that entrepreneurial spirit that's been required for people to succeed. We're seeing it go on hyperdrive, and it's really been a phenomenal, like, aside from the societal elements of COVID, we think it really will end up being a kind of massively positive tailwind industry.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mitch and Casey. I appreciate it. That was awesome. And thank you for joining us at Canna Week. Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can find these new stories and more on New Frontier Data's Cannabis Insights Daily on our website, newfrontierdata.com. Thank you again, and we'll see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.